Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, which means it's true crime time. And it's a very special Friday because it is the Friday before reveal day. And in honor of that, I have an exclusive reveal about the subject that Jen and I are going to speak to today. Jen, how are you?
I'm good. Happy fourth weekend.
Happy fourth weekend. A little bit over halfway through the year, and reveal day on July. I feel like, you know, because there hasn't been one since January, it's this long 6 month gap. And then in the second half of the year, it's, you know, 4th of July reveal day, and then Black Friday reveal day, and then on New Year's Day. So it just feels like, a lot of reveals, and it's definitely one of my, favorite times of the year. And, July 4th was the first time I had done a reveal day, I believe. And I think, God, I don't even remember now, maybe like 2007 or something like that. But I remember where I was in the office when I did it, because I had a trial like 2 days after the 4th. So I took some time off from work while I was at work and did the first reveal day. I think that's right. I think that was the first one. Anyway, it's been a long time. So, you know. But today we are going to talk about Howard Hughes, which I know is, everybody loves Howard Hughes and is always really, really interested in it. And I think that you picked out some cool things, because it's not just Howard Hughes the person, because you could talk about Howard Hughes the person for days and days and days and days. But just some of the curses, some of the cases about Howard Hughes. And one of the things that I did have a reveal, which I'm going to read now that I already did. And then I'm going to talk about another one. And it relates to a case that Jen and I talked about in episode number 183. Anyway, so this one was revealed on reveal day, January 1st, 2018. And it says, plenty of studio heads in old Hollywood basically forced actresses to have sex with them for roles. It wasn't so much a casting couch as it was sexual assault. One of the most famous studio heads is still famous today, many years after his death. He is so famous that multiple movies have been made about his life. Funny, though, most of those movies failed to discuss the horrors of working for him or being an actress under contract at his studio. If you didn't agree to have sex with him, he would rape you. If you did agree to have sex with him, then the odds were high you would contract syphilis. There was one actress who told her husband she was a virgin when they married. She wasn't. The husband figured it out when he contracted syphilis from her and divorced her almost immediately after marrying her. There was another actress who was set to marry our executive, but suddenly didn't. Reason? Our executive basically sold her to a very rich man. One of the women he really wanted but couldn't pressure because of her A-plus list fame got secretly married. This enraged our executive, who had the husband murdered. It was always portrayed as something else, but the executive did the killing and then had a torrid fling with the actress, who was afraid she would be killed if she didn't. Another actress, who our executive loved, kept putting off the executive by getting married. What did the executive do about it? Paid off the husbands to divorce the actress until she finally gave in and started sleeping with the executive. She also contracted syphilis from the executive and refused to have children for fear of passing it to them through birth. There was an actress who was probably A-minus list, Academy Award nominee. There was always a fiction that she never slept with the executive. The story was he pursued, but she declined. No such thing. He pursued and she slept with him and contracted syphilis. When she gave birth to a child with severe defects, there was a story concocted as to why. And so you have Howard Hughes. The virgin was Loretta Young. The actress sold was Rita Hayworth. The A-plus list actress who had the husband murdered was Jean Harlow. The actress with paid-off husbands was Ava Gardner. And the A-minus list Oscar nominee actress was Jean Tierney. That's always been one of my favorite blind items.
And now it's one of my favorites. I'm glad that you shared that.
Yeah, so that was one that I did back in 2018 on Reveal Day. And then this one is from August 7th, 2019. And it's a Mr. X one, and I'm not sure why it hasn't been revealed, but I guess I knew subconsciously that you and I would do this episode, and so I saved it for this. And it is this former B-minus list actor was under contract to the illiterate billionaire when our actor was killed. Our actor was closeted, but married. The actor's wife knew the actor was gay because the wife was too. It was for convenience. Our actor was killed, and to her final breath, the wife believed it was the illiterate billionaire who killed the actor, or at least had someone do it, to stop the actor from talking about the affair the actor had with the billionaire. And I'm talking about David Bacon and Howard Hughes and Greta Keller. And like I said, that is the first time that I have revealed it. And when you and I talked about The Masked Marvel, which is what David Bacon, he was, he actually brought David Bacon out in 1942, met him, brought him out to Los Angeles, gave him a 3-year contract. And he had wanted Bacon to play Billy the Kid in The Outlaw, but after a screen test, he was unsuitable, essentially. But for the next year, he remained under contract, where he was considered, quote, a high-class gentleman. But there was just nothing for him to do. And one of the crazy things is in early September of 1943, Bacon finished his role as the Masked Marvel in a 15-chapter movie serial at Republic Studios, which is what Howard Hughes owned. And during the filming, 4 of the 5 actors who were to play the Masked Marvel had been injured during filming a fighting scene. And Bacon joked that he will, quote, probably get hurt going home in the car. And that's kind of exactly what happened to him, in a way. There was, he essentially got stabbed and he was in his car. And, I mean, it was the perfect murder. I remember that. And this just was a guy who, you know, was this, he was gay and his wife was gay. She's an Austrian opera star named Greta Keller. And here's the thing that that I had totally forgot about when we talked about The Masked Marvel. And it goes to so much, what we've been talking about lately is that he and Greta lived in a mansion called Castle Hill. And the address is 844 Magnolia Drive. And it was on Lookout Mountain in Hollywood.
I was hoping you would bring that up. See how everything just kind of, it just oddly falls right into, you know, the storylines that we continue on with. And also, we had also spoke about the Lavender Marriages, the fact that Bacon was maybe, they try to say the fixers try to say he was stabbed with a stiletto, which we all know that no woman killed him. So. You know, that whole story is interesting. Everyone has to listen to, was it episode 183? It's just one of the most popular ones ever.
You know, and one of the things is that, where was it? The other thing is he had recently rented a cottage in Laurel Canyon at the bottom of Lookout Mountain. So, you know, and that is kind of where he, conducted his liaisons. And, but he had said that it was for some guys going to do work on the house or something like that. And, it's really interesting when I went back and I looked at some of the language, the detectives, found 4 persons who recognized Bacon as someone who often frequented a certain stretch of Venice Beach, which apparently, I guess, was the place where, like-minded gentlemen would go find each other.
And yes, and on his photo roll, because he had a camera, I believe, that was found in his vehicle. I'd have to go back and listen to the episode, but there was one last photo of him, which was him nude, basically. So obviously he was engaged in something sketchy right before he was stilettoed to death.
Yeah, and Greta revealed that Bacon had kept a secret diary written in code. I mean, this is how secretive, you know, he had to be. And she didn't know its location, and the police searched the house for a couple days, but her deteriorating health kind of led them to call off the search. And that stiletto was, it was a single knife wound, pierced the lower heart. And I guess the county coroner or whatever said that a person could live for 20 minutes with such a wound. And the interior of his car was just soaked with blood, but there was no blood on the outside.
Yeah, so you have him with the secret diary, and you have him being 6 degrees separated from Hughes, who initially discovered him or picked him up at a bar, and Hughes was widely obsessed with secrecy. He, too, kept weird coded diaries. He threatened everyone, you know, to not talk about his life, told his wives, multiple wives, to just be secret about him. So I think that Bacon might have picked that up from him.
Yeah, and, you know, And I would venture to say, and you and I kind of speculated about Howard Hughes in that episode, but the, you know, Howard Hughes would have maybe known about that diary.
And, oh, of course, because Howard Hughes was, Yep. Like you said, the Laurel Canyon people, what was going on in Laurel Canyon is hooked to intelligence, which you've spoke about multiple times. Howard Hughes is all wrapped up in the CIA and intelligence from the get-go, from the minute he lands in L.A. And then you have David Bacon meeting his horrible end, and people in Laurel Canyon, they just never fared well.
You know, it's crazy to me. And, you know, I still think about that, you know, that knife, they said the blade was about 6 inches.
Well, they know what they're doing. There's no telling what that weapon was, because intelligence people, they carry so much on them. There's just absolutely no telling.
And the whole thing was that the medical experts, you know, had doubted that such a knife could be used in that small car, because I think he was driving a Mini Cooper maybe or something. And but the thing is that, you know, an expert, an intelligence expert, some kind of hitman could probably pull that off.
Yeah, he had a lot of OSS guys floating around, and they said that was such a lucky stab. You know, exactly where David Bacon was stabbed. You can look up his autopsy. It's minimal, but it's there. I mean, that is someone that knew what they were doing.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just crazy. And I think that we talked about, because there was no blood on the outside, that Bacon had probably driven, you know, killer or killers around for the entire time that he bled to death.
Yeah, which means that he probably knew them.
Yeah, exactly. Which, again, leads up to the fact that, you know, maybe it was Howard Hughes, because he certainly would have known Howard Hughes, or at least somebody associated with Howard Hughes, you know, and said, hey, I need you to do a favor for this guy or whatever, pick him up. And the perfect murder. And, you know, like you said, there's the autopsy, but I think, as in, you know, a lot of cases that you and I cover, the LAPD said all the files pertaining to the case have been destroyed.
Oh, of course. Yeah, at this point, if you find anything, you're lucky. I mean, I have a couple of pieces, but it's nothing like what you would see today or what you expect. You know, it's not multiple pages or anything like that. And of course, it was highly fixed. The coroners and politicians and all of that back then were highly on the take. I mean, it's not like they're not on the take now, but back then, come on. Every story you run into, it's like, you know, Burris is taking money for bribes, and, you know, L.A. County's just a mess.
And the other thing was, now, I'm used to, by now, after every single crime that you and I have talked about, and, you know, I think we've done 80 episodes or something, and it covered probably 120 crimes. So I'm used to, by now, every single police department, especially the LAPD, we can't find the records, or they're missing. But in this one, I guess the FBI investigated it, and they also said that their files were destroyed. And I don't remember why we talked about that the FBI would be interested in it, but then it takes you back to the whole Lookout Mountain kind of thing.
There you go. Okay, so you have – this is how it happens. So you have another branch that is higher than them that answers to absolutely nobody. That would be your intelligence branch. They're off doing their own thing in Laurel Canyon and at Lookout Mountain, and they do something maybe, perhaps sketchy, knock somebody off. Maybe one of their officers do, and then you have the FBI come and poke around and look in. And you have the intelligence branch say, look away, go back and mind your business, mind your jurisdiction. So, yeah, they poked around, but you saw how quickly they let it go. They're like, we can't do anything, basically, with the CIA. So, you know, let us excuse ourselves. And you see that a lot. They just constantly stand down.
And one of this was not the first time that Howard Hughes, you know, got away with killing somebody or, you know, hiring somebody to kill somebody. I mean, he got away with it another time.
He was the Epstein / Musk of his decades, because he was an industrialist. He was an aviation expert, a defense contractor, a film director. The CIA used him as a ruse to go and work on, you know, Cold War type situations and things like that. So, I mean, this guy was just multifaceted.
No, and you know what you said about the Elon Musk thing? I mean, that makes so much sense. If you think about, you know, Howard Hughes, Elon Musk, and the, you know, kind of rich to begin with kind of thing.
They like them rich. They like them billionaires, whether you call them broke billionaires or not. They like you if you're in aviation or you have aviation shells to play with, private jets, things like that. Ways to get around and reasons for you to be lots of different weird places and not have them blamed for it. You know, if you've got a good cover story, they're looking for it.
So you had Howard Hughes, who was a billionaire, and he pushed the limits of engineering, pushed the limits of safety, used his huge bank account to make all those kind of things happen, and at the same time had all those kind of gossipy celebrity romances He also, just like Elon Musk, went through executives like crazy, made strange business decisions, invited conflict by basically telling politicians to, you know, screw off.
Well, he could afford to.
Yeah. You know, and if you think about it, it's the, you know, the same kind of thing with Elon Musk, where he, you know, got into a fight with the Securities Exchange Commission, you know, went through, burned, you know, I think it's through $5 billion in the last 9 or 10 years to popularize his electric cars and solar power. I mean,
it's the same thing. When I look at Howard Hughes and I look at Musk, I see a mirror, and I also see patterns just within the CIA, you know, everything to do, like you said, with aviation, satellites, security, things like that. I mean, Musk is, to me, no different.
And, you know, Musk was married to a British actress, to Lulu Riley. That's who he has a lot of kids with. But he also was married to an author, Justine. And then, of course, he's got, as if you've listened to the podcast or read the blinds, you know about his relationship that he had with Amber Heard. And, of course, now he has a child with the singer Grimes. So, I mean, they both, it's these, and most business people, they don't want to, first of all, they don't really usually come out to LA. And then Howard Hughes did, came from Texas. Elon Musk, you know, came and, but it's just, you know,
wait a minute though. Isn't Elon Musk trying to relocate to Texas? Isn't he angry with California wanting to now move to Texas?
Yes, he is. But I just, you know, he could move.
The mirror.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Cause he wants to go to Texas where Howard Hughes is from. And, you know, he could move the, what's also, he could move his factory from Oakland or whatever to Texas, but it would be harder with SpaceX. And that's the other thing, is that, you know, SpaceX is headquartered, you know, a stone's throw essentially from LAX, and LAX was created from, you know, Howard Hughes's company, you know,
right,
that he had out there. So,
yeah,
just,
so he needs to stay put just for old time's sake. I don't think Musk is going anywhere. He's all talk, but I did find that to be interesting that it's kind of a, I don't know, those two just very similar.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if now what Elon needs to do to make it kind of come full circle is to buy like a movie studio or something like that, right? Or a casino, you know, just to really cement it. And then he needs to go into hiding for the last 10 or 15 years of his life.
Oh, yes. Be a recluse. Grow your hair out. And no, wait, stop there, because he's already acting crazy. Let's not encourage him. Elon, just be good. You have a new baby. Just be good.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's just kind of crazy. But yeah, you know, and you know how Hughes wanted to, you know, was always traveling around the world trying to set speed records and things like that. You know, pushing the limits of what you could do with aviation. And it's the same kind of thing with SpaceX, right?
You know? And Elon Musk is known to climb out onto wings of his planes and do similar stunts. So again, these guys are very paralleled. But Hughes, he suffered more than Elon, because this guy would give himself his own burn notice. You know, as we go on through his story, he gets so messed up that it's what ruins his life, essentially.
Yeah, because, I mean, Hughes survived three major airplane crashes and an automobile crash, you know, and his head was just destroyed in all of those. And, you know, I agree. I think that because if you just look at the outside, oh, he became a recluse or whatever, and you don't, you know, go into, okay, well, what made him want to be a recluse or turn into one? And
yeah, you have to go there, because it's not what it seems. I mean, the guy was in a lot of pain at one point, burned over 78% of his body. I mean, he just kept crashing, and the guy didn't stop flying after that. You know, he would climb back into the cockpits and just start this aviation project all over again, because, again, he's being pressured by, you know, the Air Force and also CIA to get these projects off the ground. And he gets, you know, a morphine addiction, allegedly. And we'll talk about how he died. But I mean, you have to give him credit in his whole story. You know, it's not that he just broke down for no reason. I mean, the guy was literally a walking ball of pain.
Oh, for sure. And also, I just remember that Elon Musk had tweeted that he thought that he might be bipolar. So again,
yeah,
you know, it's there are a lot of crazy similarities. So in July of 1936, going back to when he got away with a death.
This is something that most people don't know about him. They seem so surprised.
Yeah. So he's it's Howard Hughes and an unnamed woman, and Pat DeChicco. They left Trader Vic's, and Howard Hughes was driving. And at the corner of 3rd and Lorraine, his vehicle struck and killed 59-year-old Gabriel Meyer. And the car was traveling at a really high speed, and Meyer was on a crosswalk when he was hit. And the L.A. County coroner, Frank Nance, who was the same guy who handled Thelma Todd's death certificate, found Hughes innocent of any wrongdoing.
Oh, of course he did.
Even though there were skid marks 50 feet long at the scene of the accident.
So that automatically tells you the rate of speed that old Hughes was going as he's careening through this whole pedestrian crosswalk area.
I mean, 50 feet, and you still are going through this intersection at a huge speed. They said that the body was tossed 100 feet by the impact. I mean, how fast do you have to be going to where you've already slammed on the brakes for 50 feet? And then
he had been out partying. Him and the female and old Pat were throwing back bottles of champagne. So by the time he got behind the wheel of his Dustinburg convertible coupe, he was pretty lit. So he probably really was cooking it through the pedestrian zone. I mean, to hit someone and knock him 100 feet and kill him instantly. I mean, yeah, you were flying.
Yeah. And a doctor at the hospital, where Hughes was taken for observation, noted that he had been drinking, so Hughes was booked on suspicion of negligent homicide. But the charges were suddenly dropped by the time of the coroner's inquiry. And I'm thinking it has to do also with the fact that the only eyewitness suddenly decided to change his story completely.
Oh, yes.
I wonder if there was a little bit of money involved in that.
I would say so, because anytime you see – look, hey, just to put it this way, Howard Hughes' first call was Archie McDonald, who's a fixer. So, yeah. Of course, Archie comes in and fixes his problems. And, yeah, the employee was a UPS – or the witness was a UPS employee. And he's the one who said that Hughes was traveling at a, quote, terrific rate of speed, and that the pedestrian had crossed the streetcar crosswalk and was in the safety zone, and then Hughes was at fault. By the time Archie gets a hold of him, that guy changes his whole story. He says the police, they wrote it down wrong. They misquoted him. He's backing out.
Yes. I mean, he said all of a sudden then, the victim stepped out directly right in the path of Hughes' car, which he then recalled was being driven slowly and in a responsible manner. I mean, and
I'm
so
laughing
the DA,
because that chick that was in the car with him, right? So he had a woman in the car with him, and if he wasn't guilty of anything and they weren't lit, why did he push her out of the car and she went and she fled the scene, jumped on a trolley, and got the heck out of there?
Yeah.
They didn't know who she was. They didn't know who she was for the longest time.
And then Hughes paid Meyer's family $10,000, which is about $300,000 in today's money, to help them in their time of need. And then I guess more payments were made later. So, I mean, I guess there was somewhat of a settlement. But if you think about how rich Howard Hughes was at the, I mean, Howard Hughes, people, you know, he was not a self-made millionaire or anything like that. I mean, was bored in Texas. He made $5,000 a day for doing nothing. I mean,
yeah, he was basically orphaned, right? And his parents were the ones that had the money, especially the father. He left behind the Hughes Tool Company, which Howard Hughes went on to develop into a multi-business of aviation, things like that. But his dad was the one who made him so rich because he left him the sole heir. And again, Archie McDonald helped him get his hands on all that money, too.
Yeah, I mean, it just so people think, oh, you know, he came out, but he was. A big, I'm trying to think of the right word. Anyway, he was a playboy who had a bunch of money and then kind of said, you know what? I'm going to make it as a film producer or a film director. You know, I'm going to go out to Hollywood and take my talents out there, you know? And that never works out. It never works out, people. I'm just telling you right now that if you're in some other profession and then you think you can come out and, you know, do something like that, chances are good that it's not going to happen. And people referred to Howard Hughes as the sucker with with money. And he did, you know, make two movies total as a director, but he made this movie, Hell's Angels. And it had been a while since I had looked at it. And it was nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography because, I mean, the aviation scenes in it are so amazing. And I don't know how many pilots ended up dead filming that, but there were quite a few. And
I have no doubt if he was involved because he was all about crashing and burning. And yes, he did create Gene Harlow, but, you know, as quickly as he made people and developed their careers and stuff, he'd fall out with them. You know, he would not like you overnight. I've read that over and over in his biographies and autobiographies that he just does not get along with people for too long.
Do you think that that was because of his, you know, medical conditions? I mean,
yes.
Was he like that maybe before all these crashes and stuff?
Oh, honey, yes, because he had likely some type of, bless him, mental disorder going on from a young age. He was orphaned young, so yeah. He has no parents. He has all these people coming at him because his dad was a millionaire to begin with. So he had to fight for his inheritance and all that stuff, and then he had to make sure nobody took his money. He became a paranoid, in my opinion, schizophrenic. And also, he was born with OCD because his mother, she put something in his head about being constantly very clean. So he's constantly washing his hands. He had that OCD just so terribly. He would take napkins to pick things up instead of using his own hands and then still scrub his hands. So, I mean, he had a lot going on.
And it's so remarkable that he was such a clean freak and then turned into a guy who probably never took a shower the last few years of his life.
Oh, my gosh. If you look at Howard Hughes in the beginning, like just look at him throughout his life and then look at what happened in the end. It is baffling because he becomes in so much pain that he just gives up on life. You know, he quit showering. He doesn't clip his nails. His hair's out of control. He was absolutely unrecognizable when he perished.
One of the curses, and, you know, something that I read, because we were, you know, talking about curses, and, you know, there was the movie made by Leonardo DiCaprio. But for a long time, no movie about Howard Hughes really could get made. And I'm not talking about Melvin and Howard because that's not really about Howard Hughes. It's more about Melvin. And I think there was a TV movie once, but that was essentially it until, you know, The Aviator came along. And then Warren Beatty tried to make a Howard Hughes movie, and it totally bombed. And speaking of that movie about Howard Hughes, that's also – it was a Steve Bing produced movie. So there was these curses, and I think the curses kind of stretched to when people tried to make the movies, and it just kind of like he reached his tentacles out from, you know, the grave and kept these movies, you know, kept the curse going. But there was this time in 1943, so 7 years after the car accident, and he himself flew a helicopter, from California. Carrying two aviation inspectors, two of Hughes's employees, and Ava Gardner. And they went to Vegas, and he dropped Ava off in Vegas, and then they proceeded to Lake Mead to conduct tests. And then the test flight crashed into Lake Mead, and it killed two of the people on board. So, you know, but Howard Hughes just, you know, suffered some injuries, and it would have... You know, I wonder if Ava Gardner, if she'd still been on there, if she would have gotten
killed. Oh, gosh. Thank goodness she wasn't. I love her. She's one of my top 10 favorite old Hollywood actresses.
Speaking of the people that he dated, and there's a ton of them, but, you know, Olivia de Havilland was one of them, and she just celebrated her 104th birthday the other day.
Yes.
So happy birthday to her. And always be nice to Olivia because she will sue you. Even at the age of 104, never say anything negative about Olivia.
She's fabulous.
But he dated her. Well, he was having sex with her while he was also having sex with her sister.
He was having sex with everyone. Allegedly Katharine Hepburn, but, you know, Katharine Hepburn allegedly kept a girlfriend. And then from there, it's a series of actresses and actors. So, I mean, he was banging everybody.
And it's interesting because, well, I'll talk about it later, but there was... One of the things that, you know, he's always okay. He's had sex with a lot of women, but there, I guess, as he aged, or then he was less able to perform, so to speak.
Yeah, he couldn't even get it up. He had syphilis, and on top of that, he had all these injuries. And also, if you're on morphine and all these other opiates for a long, long time, you can forget it. Like, it's just, it's not going to happen anymore as you age.
Yeah. So apparently later in life, a lot of these sexual conquests were more of a masturbatory experience, I believe was one actress put it. But, you know, while working on these aircrafts, so I guess his hangar was struck by lightning, which burned one completely original aircraft. And, you know, it just, but it was at that time that the Army said, hey, you know, we really want to do some things, you know, we high altitude photographic reconnaissance. And that plane was the XF-11, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's the one. And that one burnt. And they said, okay, we'll rebuild it, but this time make it more aluminum. So it'll be substantial. And of course he did, but they didn't exactly finance that. They were just kind of filling him out at that time. So you can see how they're sort of using him a little bit, you know, like you said, for his money. So he rebuilds it.
Yeah. And also, let's not forget that 1946, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, even though I just did, that's when the Lookout Mountain Laboratory started, right? Was 1946.
Yes.
Yes. So you have all these Army Air Force guys coming, right? And I'm sure that they were filming a lot of this stuff, and that's part of the treasure trove of Lookout Mountain things, because you do have...
I keep up with Hughes and Lookout Mountain and what's classified, and to this date, everything to do with Hughes and Lookout Mountain is still classified, and also what is the Project Azorian, which was the AKA the Jennifer Project with a Cold War sub that they used him to pull out of the sea, that is still classified, both the film and the document. So CIA not letting go of that anytime soon. In fact, they don't even want to talk about that it exists.
Yeah. And so again, you know, the Lookout Mountain people, I guess it makes sense that they came out because they were doing filming. There was testing in the Nevada, New Mexico deserts and stuff. But, you know, a lot of it's, you know, Howard Hughes and, you know, he's out in Hollywood, and it's just this kind of fit where, you know, you can tell that he had a lot, you know, to do with these kind of things. But so he has this inaugural flight of this XF-11, and that was July 7th, 1946. So we're almost on the anniversary of that.
Yeah. So July is never good to him because he had the pedestrian death in July, and then this also occurs in July.
And so the story goes that there was this Marine Master Sergeant, and his name was William Durkin, and he was headed to a date, and he happened upon the burning aircraft of this XF-11, which Howard Hughes had been piloting. And, you know, he said, quote, "I heard a sound inside the cockpit like someone pounding. At the same time, I heard a scream of agony, and I knew a man was burning to death." And so he went into this fire, and he rescued Hughes. I mean, that takes some guts to do that. When you have this plane and it's on fire, and he rescued Hughes, and like you said earlier, I mean, third degree burns to 78% of his body. I think that people would have a tough time surviving that kind of thing now, let alone in 1946.
That's horrible. I mean, I can't think of anything worse than a burn. And then on top of that, cracked ribs, multiple broken bones. His chest and lungs were basically collapsed in, and they said that his heart had shifted a little bit. He had two blood transfusions and surgeries, and they gave him a 50-50 shot at survival. But he's Howard Hughes, so he could afford to get the best care. And, you know, they worked around the clock to make sure that he would pull through.
Yeah, you know, and people debate if Hughes paid Durkin gratitude payments.
Well, he tried.
I know he tried, right? But this Durkin guy, such a good guy that, you know, he kept trying. And I know that there was one of the things that happened was there was a letter that he wrote to Durkin, and it was about 5 months after the accident. And it just says, "Dear Sergeant Durkin, I'm writing this letter as Christmas approaches. Think of no more appropriate time to express once more my gratitude for the aid you rendered me at the time of the accident, which befell my company's plane, the XF-11. I'm sorry that your Marine Corps unit left for China while I was still convalescing, so that I did not have the opportunity of thanking you both personally and in behalf of my company. I've been thinking a great deal, however, about how to concretely convey this very real appreciation to you. I have discussed this with the officers of my company, with my friends. I have sought to find a way that would be most beneficial to you. I'm somewhat blocked because I know nothing of your hopes or plans, except that for the next few years you wish to stay in the Marines, and at present you are stationed in China. Someday, however, you may feel you would like to leave the Marines, so I would like to propose this plan to you. When that day arrives and you return from China, will you let me know and come to see me? At that time, you may be interested in some phase of aviation or some other activity with which I may be connected. If so, I may be able to assist you in obtaining some sort of position which may lead to your achieving the result you desire. In any event, I would like to see you and discuss your own views of how you feel I may most be helpful. In the meantime, you may be able to use a little cash, even in China. My company, which feels duly grateful to you, is sending a small check. Another will follow each month until you return here for the discussion I have suggested. I will always be grateful for your courageous action. I'm glad that you are uninjured. I hope you are enjoying yourself out there on the other side of the world. I'll be looking forward to seeing you when you return. My very best regards, Howard Hughes. So the amount that we think it was what, $200 or something like that?
Yeah, looked like $200 and a lifetime pass to the Hollywood Players Club, which was a huge hangout for Hughes. So he wanted the guy to have a little bit of fun. But, of course, the family went on to say that they weren't real sure that Durkin ever really cashed payments from Hughes. I tend to think the guy might have cashed a couple because of the lawsuit that Hughes filed against, the aviation company? And inside of those docket notes, it clearly says that he is paying someone $200 a month.
Yes. Yes. And Kimberly Durkin said that Hughes and Durkin were friends, and that they, you know, hung out with each other for many years. So, you know, and he did accept at least one gift. He got the steering wheel, like the control yoke from the crash plane. And he, I guess, cause he had gripped it as the plane went down, wondering whether he would live or die. And it sounds almost exactly like the end of Captain America. Anyway,
it does. And how we know about these items is that they all eventually hit auction. The family decided that they were going to auction them off and put them out into the world because they wanted to share them. And, you know, that's how we started to figure out pieces of the story about the money, about the yoke. And you can see those pictures online if you just type in Swan Auctions.
And because Durkin lived to be 90, and he only died. I mean, he died in the 2000s, right? I think he died in
2006.
So, I mean, you know, he lived a long life, and I think he retired as a captain in the Marines, I want to say, just off the top of my head. Yeah, so he lived a long life, and then, you know, these items, you know, that at auction and everything like that, and it's kind of an odd collection of, you know, items and memorabilia, really. You wouldn't think that the yoke would be, hey, do you want the, yeah, I'll take the yoke.
That's pretty historic. I mean, if he was gripping it as he went down, he was like, okay, well, I'm either going to live or die. Here we go. So, you know, it's Howard Hughes, aviation, industrial, amazing man. So, yeah, of course, I wonder what that went for at auction. I'll have to look that up. But that
I'm looking it up right now because I want to know.
Look it up. But that XF-11, he eventually, after he healed, climbed back into that and then actually made that work. He was successful in piloting that. So,
Let me see what it was sold for. I don't see. I want to know the price. Hold on. I see the pictures, but I don't see the price really quickly for what it went. So we'll find out, and then I'll try and put it on the things. It's really, I mean, just, it's really interesting that the items that he had. So, anyway, would you have got back in a plane after that? You know,
no, but I'm not Howard Hughes, and with his brain, I mean, yeah, he would have. Cause I mean, after his crash, right, he's burned on 78% of his body. His heart's been shifted and his bones are broken. He's a hot mess and he's lying there and he's like, well, at least my brain still works. So you could tell he was already, the wheels were in his head were turning about, I'm going to get back in that plane. And he did.
Yeah. And you know, you had mentioned before about intelligence agencies. They love the billionaires. And I think one of the reasons is, especially with Howard Hughes, think about all the traveling around the world he did, all the different places that he could go. in that plane and where he could land. And, you know, he's famous, and so he could do a lot of intelligence work. Plus, he had access to technology and military stuff, so he's probably getting a top secret clearance for any of that kind of stuff. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, he was a defense contractor, kind of a 007 kind of guy when he was younger and hadn't had all these head injuries. And, you know, you could see something similar in Epstein.
Oh, without a doubt. Hughes was like the original to me, 007, and then Epstein came along and was the more swashbuckling, I guess, 007 type of Bond guy. Hughes was smoother. He definitely had better covers.
And not a pedophile.
And the whole trafficking thing, right? Gross.
Yeah. I mean, and if you think, next, you know, one of the names with Hughes, is a guy named Sam Belzberg. And Sam Belzberg was this huge influence in connecting Wexner up with Epstein. You know, and it's kind of crazy. If you think about, Sam Belzberg and, you know, it's just kind of a voyeur in Hollywood, but then, you know, and then you have Hughes and Epstein, and it's really weird that Sam Belzberg, who was, you know, one of the original para-billionaire kind of thing from other businesses that end up in Hollywood, you know, whether you have like Mark Rich or Marvin Davis or Kerry Packer or Mel Simon or Ron Perlman, and then you have Sam Belzberg and just how he connects Wexner up with Epstein. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, that guy, and also hooked to Paul Allen. So, yeah, that's another rabbit hole to get into.
And it's not even, you know, if you think about and the Bronfmans, mm-hmm. you know, they got all into Hollywood and everything as well. You know, it's just
because Hollywood is the ultimate cover for your whole cloak and cork shoes. If you want to do something, you need a cover. So, I mean, basically Hollywood will prepare you for that. Not always just resort people back to Argo. You know, just look at what exactly they did there, and all of this stuff is just on a much wider scale.
I was just reading the article about when he survived that plane crash, and it's just, he was 41 years old. I mean, that's another thing. 41 years old, and he still was able to, with a 78% burns and the broken left collarbone, 7 rib fractures, fractured nose, lacerations of the scalp, a small fracture of the skull, a puncture wound in the left knee, and then, like you said earlier, crush injuries to the lungs. I mean, just that is one remarkable recovery.
It is. And he was also allegedly highly doped up, and he was shooting drugs up intravenously. They were prescribed to him. You know, they were given him morphine and things like that, codeine, just to help him get through. So that's how he was able to keep pushing and pushing. And he was stubborn. So, of course, he was going to keep piloting this stuff. But when they found him, how he died was basically on an airplane. He was leaving Acapulco and trying to get back to Houston to get treated. He died either mid-flight or by the time that he reached the Houston hospital. But in his autopsy, what is just disturbing is that he had injected himself so much that he actually had the needles inside of his arm, where he was horrible at injecting, and he would just leave them in there. And that alone gave him horrible infections.
Can you imagine that? I mean, that's...
No.
Oh, and one of the other things about the crash, because I'm reading another article, was apparently he was conscious for hours after the crash, and appeared comfortable while we were taking x-rays, said a nurse. That's another... this guy...
They had to have gave him something. I mean, he was almost burned alive. When the guy pulled him out of the crash, he said, literally, I could hear a man screaming as if he was burning alive.
And firemen, it took them hours to subdue the flames. So think, I mean, that plane was burning for hours and hours, and this guy, Durkin, in whatever, this must have been an inferno, you know, gets him out of there.
He almost walked away. I mean, that plane, it was, had to be on high fuel. I guess he had just taken off when he crashed. So
exactly.
That's maybe why it burned for so long. But when Durkin first saw the crash, he thought there was no way they could be survivors. And he didn't hear anything, so he was starting to walk away. That's when he started banging, and he's like, oh, man. You know, there's someone in there. So had he walked away, we wouldn't had Hughes, you know, as long as we did. But, I mean, that Durkin guy is definitely an epic hero.
He is. And it looks like in this, in a different article, that he actually was assisted by somebody. And I can't read the, I think it says James Gustin, who's 22 years old and a son of a retired Swedish industrialist and owner of the second house that was hit by the plummeting plane. So people forget that there was other things on there. I wanted to talk about one thing, and I'm looking for it. It was Gene Peters. No, hold on. Oh, it's too bad. I'm not going to find it. Here we go. So Hughes's involvement, he also was involved with the mafia. And this is something that I don't think people really talk about all that much, but he ordered his aide, Bob Mayhew, to act as a link between CIA assassination experts and the mafia capo, Don Giovanni. Rosselli, for the mob's repeated bungled attempts on Cuban President Fidel Castro's life in the mid-60s. So here he is arranging the go-between between CIA assassination experts and the mafia to kill Fidel Castro. So he's definitely involved. And then also Hughes, even though he was working with the mob, he had swindled the mob. This is a guy who managed to swindle the mob. In 1952, he offered to sell them RKO studios, and they'd accepted. They made a deposit of $1.5 million, and then he leaked details of their backgrounds to the press, so the deal collapsed, but he kept the deposit. I mean, to cross the mob, steal their money, and not even have to worry about, you know, them coming after you. This sounds like
there might have been a little more tied into the deal that maybe Hughes wasn't getting, and he wasn't going to give an inch until they gave him exactly what he wanted. But the thing with the FBI, you had asked in the beginning, like, you know, why were they coming kind of in and out of these things? Because you have Hughes wrapped up in the intelligence house, and then you have him also, you know, the FBI is always interested in mob activity, so they're looking at him for that. And then he also carried the ID where he was the alias of John T. Canover, which is the ID he actually was, I want to say, shipped to the Houston hospital with, because that's the ID he had on his dead body, and they had to use fingerprints, and it was actually the FBI that showed up and fingerprinted him to prove that he was Howard Hughes, because that's how terrible he looked.
And, you know, he invented the seamless bra. He employed a team of aeronautical experts to enhance Jane Russell's uplift in The Outlaw. So as a result of that, the seamless bra was invented. So, I mean, just all these little nuggets and things like that.
He's the guy who would have the chauffeur driver, because normally he didn't drive himself. That's what's so weird about him killing the pedestrian, is normally he would be chauffeured around places. He would have the chauffeur slow down over speed bumps as to protect the actress's breast. You know, don't go over them too rough, because you don't want to tear their tissue. I mean, he was that guy.
Yeah. And speaking of tissues, this is an interesting little tidbit that I found. So by 1960, Hughes was still wheeling and dealing and controlled a vast empire, but was slipping into such decrepitude that an aide described his body odor as resembling that of a dead goat. And by now, Hughes had pretty much retired into his own cocoon, still communicating with his minions by phone, but festering naked for months, lying on a bed of Kleenex, the only nod to convention being a tissue occasionally placed over his genitals when an aide entered the room. I mean, this, and as part of that, I guess he had his team of engineers work around the clock to design a bed for him that was in movable sections. So it had like this aperture and a pipe to get rid of his waste. And then because of all that, though, the flies came and he would go berserk if he even saw a speck on a light bulb. So you can imagine, I mean, the mental torture that this guy was going through the last, you know, years of his life. I mean,
oh, yeah, he was definitely in his own mental prison. The guy who co-produced The Outlaw with him said that on set, Hughes was so crazy about Jane Russell's blouse and how the fact that the seams of the blouse made it look like that she had three nipples. So, I mean, he was just obsessed with just fixing these minute problems that no one else in the whole world saw. And he said that Hughes was the most moodiest guy he'd ever worked with, and that he didn't wish him on anyone. So you have that. You have Hughes, who is putting tissues over his a private section. And apparently he would eat the same thing for dinner all the time. He just wanted a New York strip steak, and he wanted it cooked medium rare. And he just had just these hang-ups, and he kept them his whole life.
You know, I can't imagine, first of all, what it was like for him mentally the last few years of his life. I can't imagine what it was like for the people who worked for him the last few years of his life. And I'm not just talking about, you know, employees of his various companies, but just think about, you know, his nurses or, you know, maid or housekeepers or whatever. I mean, it just must have been a horrific experience. I don't care how much he paid them, you know? I mean, anyway, but it is, I mean, Howard Hughes, if you're talking about Hollywood, if you're talking about, you know, the CIA, if you're talking about intelligence, you're talking about the mafia, I mean, he kind of encapsulates all of Hollywood in that 40s and 50s, you know, and early part of the 60s, and just bringing together Hollywood and the war machinery and defense departments and movie studios kind of thing. And it just, he is the first kind of connection between government, military, and Hollywood, I think.
Yeah, he's one of the ones that I say married it up.
Exactly. That is a very good way to put it. Anyway, that is it for this episode. The reveal day is 4th of July, starts at 9 a.m. Pacific time. I hope that everybody will take a look at it.
Don't miss that list. That is so exciting. Everyone just go to the blog, go look at that. Inti's amazing.
Thank you. I think you're amazing too. And, we will see each other next week.
Yes. And happy 4th, everyone.
Happy 4th.
Bye.
Bye.